It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the charitable organization behind Milwaukee Public Schools as the foundation gets a new leader. And we explore the philanthropic work these foundations do and the projects they take on that are not achievable through a district's annual budget. Call in with your questions about how school foundations operate and what they raise money for and why. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tiffany Tardy is executive director of the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation. Tiffany, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you this morning.
So why do taxpayer-funded schools need charitable foundations?
Well, that's a great question. The foundations have become more and more accessible, and you're seeing them happen and pop up across the state of Wisconsin as well as across the country over the last several years. In history, you probably would have seen that more with private schools or with universities. But these days, with public schools and funding being less and less from our state budgets, we're relying more on foundations because we're able to then help support our public school education with raising additional dollars from our community, with being able to, support some of those different projects across the district that perhaps cannot be funded through the budget.
We're going to get into some of those projects in just a moment, but if you could help us make a distinction, how do foundations like yours differ from the fundraising and charitable efforts of PTAs, parent-teacher associations?
Right. So the PTAs are really looking at their specific school and where their kids go to school. And they're doing great work because they're doing similar work. So I think the communication between the PTAs and the school foundations is important, but the foundation really is able to serve across the district and being able to serve the different priorities across schools, as well as within kind of the strategic priorities of the district, and being able to support project infrastructure, enrichment, all those different pieces. So we're able to have more of a strategic approach across the community and looking at the district-wide efforts and being able to then move the community forward.
But I hear you saying that you're listening to PTAs, you're having relationships with them because they really understand the issues more at the school-based level, at that more micro level, if you will.
That's absolutely right. And they're so critical and important because, many of those ideas are stemming from the PTAs because they have that pulse on what's happening in the schools and what the true needs are of the kids in the schools and the, teachers and administrators in the schools.
So looking back over your career for the past 15 years, you focused your work on higher ed. Why move to an organization, a nonprofit that works with younger students?
Yes, great question. So yes, my background is in higher education. And so I've been able to see, the sort of through college pipeline, but the things that happen in college, directly relate to what happens in K-12 education. And so this opportunity, I think, allows me to have a greater impact on the, public schools education here in the city of Milwaukee, and being able to make sure that those access and resources are available to students, then that, directly impacts what happens post K-12 into higher education or industry or career. So for me, this role allows me to have, I think, greater impacts and really kind of going backwards in the pipeline, knowing that if we can really focus our time and energy in K-12, then that's what leads to our future.
Talking about school funding with Tiffany Tardy, a new leader of the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation, looking at what these types of charitable organizations can provide that the district budget cannot. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tiffany, let's look more closely at some of the projects. In 2019, the foundation had received nearly $1.7 million in contributions and in grants. Where is that money needed most for Milwaukee schools?
Yes, great question. Well, I would be remiss if we didn't talk about the pandemic and the impact of the pandemic on all schools and all education, but the direct hit on public schools. So I think there was a major focus over the last several years with the Connect Milwaukee initiative, trying to make sure that all of our students were able to have access to internet, access to online school so that they could continue to keep up with their education and academic curriculum. So a lot of those dollars were committed to making sure our kids and families were connected, as well as making sure that, there was still access to basic needs like meals and things of that nature. And really, I think the foundation is also, even in the midst of kind of some of those additional needs, really has been focusing on projects that relate to kind of infrastructure. So thinking about our play fields and play yards, we have our Green Schools initiative that focuses on being able to beautify those playgrounds and provide outdoor classroom spaces, greenhouses at some of our schools, creating those opportunities for kids to be able to learn outdoors, as well as being able to have that safe and positive experience for the community around the schools. So that's been a really strong initiative for the foundation over the last several years. Last year, we were able to raise $330,000 on behalf of the schools to revitalize five different playgrounds, which has been amazing to see. And then additionally, we're able to then help support some of the different efforts throughout schools. So raising dollars for school supplies and being able to support teachers and some of the needs in the classrooms. And then also some of those more career focused things like our STEM fair that we've been able to host, which is something that's a really cool effort because it's bringing together students across the different high school or schools in the district, as well as then our community members and corporate leaders being able to really, focus that energy on kids who are interested in STEM. And then I would say we another example of that is what's something that's coming up in April is our Unsoul World Fair, which is like close to 3,000 kids that we've been able to support with their projects and bringing it. It's just a beautiful experience of being able to celebrate different cultures and different backgrounds and helping students having more of that worldview. And then the final piece I would note is around our scholarships. And so still being able to, focus on what's happening within the district, but then also thinking about future, talent pipeline and workforce for our kids. And so raising nearly $300,000 over the last year, which is a foundation record, directly for student scholarships for going on to higher education. So a lot of really, I think, cool and great things going on in the district to one, help fill in gaps, but then to also really make sure that kids are having, essential enrichment opportunities, across the district. And, they're just such amazing kids and just making sure that they have equitable access to resources, and for the things that they need.
I want to touch on, elaborate on that last piece you mentioned about scholarships, because the application period for more than 20 college scholarships from the foundation, it closes soon, next week. What is the hardest part about giving away these scholarships? What do you grapple with?
Oh, great question. And scholarships really is a big part of my background, and the work that I've done over the years. And so there's so many different layers to scholarships. And then, starting with honestly, applying to schools, the financial aid process, knowing what you actually need. And so oftentimes, I think some of those concerns or not having the full picture can be challenging for students to then think about applying to scholarships. But I think there's some great work that's being done within the district and the community to really encourage students to apply for scholarships. But then there's also so many different entities that have scholarships within either an institution or throughout the community. And so how do you find those scholarships? Which, those are the online portals. Those can get overwhelming. So I think it's just some of that, like just initial, what am I even supposed to do to apply for a scholarship is some of the challenge. But then also, when you get a scholarship and you know, university costs are also continuing to rise. Oftentimes scholarships are 1 year only, the first year kind of transition to college scholarships. And that can be really challenging as a student enters into their sophomore or junior year. Tuition goes up, you know, the aid that they're receiving goes down as they're losing some scholarships, perhaps. And then they have, you know, much bigger gaps than they anticipated going into their college education. So those are some of the things that that I grapple with, because, you know, you want to make sure that kids have a full understanding of the financial implications of a college education, because, you know, it is quite an undertaking. And when you're an 18-year-old trying to figure out the world, it can become a bit overwhelming.
Tiffany Tardy is the new leader of the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation, and you can call in with questions about how foundations work to fund projects and scholarships, programs for school districts, and what's happening in your own schools through this type of philanthropy. 800-642-1234. You can join in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the new leader of the nonprofit Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation. Tiffany Tardy is here. The organization raises money for the district for scholarships, facilities, special programming, things that fall outside district budgets. Call in with questions and comments about school foundation philanthropy and the impact on your district. 800-642-1234. Tiffany, from your vantage point, how dependent are school districts in Wisconsin on foundations like yours?
Great question. I would say there is a strong dependency, or increasingly strong dependency, on the foundation's work as schools, you know, work to address the additional needs of students in public schools. And so it is becoming just critical, the work of the foundations, because I think it's also the financial support, but being able to be that connector and bridge builder across the community that increases access to opportunities, or increases access to, you know, think about or dream about some of the different projects that we can be doing. Because I think, you know, oftentimes with public schools, it's like, how do we just, you know, educate kids? And thinking about the difference of being in, you know, suburban schools or private schools, where there's the education, the enrichment, the, you know, athletics, the arts. And so many of those things are becoming more difficult to be able to fund, or to be able to have those opportunities for kids in our public schools. And foundations are really able to help, you know, meet those needs. And so I would say that they're becoming more important than ever.
I want to make sure that we are able to dig in here to infrastructure, because you mentioned, you know, some classroom labs, playgrounds, play fields, other types of infrastructure related things. And, you know, Wisconsin schools, they had the highest number of referendums last year in about two decades. You know, many were asking for school renovations and basic maintenance issues with infrastructure and additions. How does your foundation prioritize infrastructure, and how do you look at those types of projects?
Right. Well, and I think we have to, you know, recognize that the, you know, the budget is really trying to address so many things, right? Because there's so many needs in public schools. And so it is difficult to, you know, make decisions around, you know, what things can the district actually, you know, prioritize or fund. Like you said, it's something that, you know, the state is screaming for or asking for, but I think it's just difficult to prioritize that when there's some other, you know, needs that take priority, obviously. So I think that with the foundation, we are really trying to, you know, look at, like you said, schools or, you know, spaces that have, you know, high need, that, and we're trying to think from an equitable lens, right? Of like, what spaces can we, you know, support? And it really does, you know, take the administrators of that particular school, the, you know, the families, the whole community coming together to be able to, you know, make a project go. So I think it's a blend of, you know, what is it that the foundation is able to help, you know, rally the troops around, as well as then what can the schools also do, or, you know, where are the schools that have the, you know, highest need that we can actually help support.
You've mentioned equity a number of times here. I'm wondering, is funding from the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation allocated evenly throughout the district, or how do you look at where you target the funds, you know, whether it is a wealthier area or a low-income neighborhood? How do you grapple with that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think that with, you know, nearly 80% of our students in the district coming from an economically disadvantaged, you know, background and family, I think it really is, you know, for lack of better round words, you know, the level playing ground, like all of our students have need and all of our schools have need. And so for us, it's really, you know, I think oftentimes projects will come to us from, like, you know, that. So a great example would be Gensland School that I was just visiting yesterday, which is one of our schools in the district that supports a high number of students with special needs and medical needs. And so that school really, you know, is special because they have all of these different ways that they've been able to support kids and, you know, making the different infrastructure changes to adapt to the needs of those kids. And so one of the things that Gensland really wanted was to create a new library space that's, you know, innovative, that, you know, is accessible for their kids. And so their principal and, you know, one of the librarians and then some, you know, some friends, some parents all got together with this idea and just started thinking about, you know, what they could do to make this happen. And so they started, like you think, like we talked about, maybe the PTAs, where they're starting at their school on the ground, trying to make that happen. And then they were able to reach out to the foundation to say, how can you support us in trying to make this happen? And then when we got involved, we were able to then work with, you know, some of the different foundations in the area, Bader Philanthropies, or yes, Bader. And you know, really be able to kind of help bring the project along. So oftentimes the projects come to us from those, you know, committed folks within the schools.
Talking about the role of outside fundraising in public schools with Tiffany Tardy, the new executive director of the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the actual raising money component. We heard from Katrina called from Grand Chute to say that they don't really approve of students asking for money for the school. For example, going door to door and selling something. And schools, Katrina says, shouldn't use children like that. Can you talk a bit about the actual fundraising that goes on?
Sure. And I think that we really try to connect with as many, you know, foundations, individuals, MPS, you know, alum, MPS crowd, folks who want to move the city forward, our corporate friends within the community, and thinking about, you know, these different areas of need. And so we really try to have buckets of priorities. So being able to help support enrichment opportunities like, you know, the field trips to the zoo or to, you know, the theater and things of that nature. And then buckets around workforce and how we can support career development in our schools, as well as then, you know, the scholarship buckets, and then those kind of infrastructure buckets that we talked about. So we're really, you know, in the community, and I think telling the stories about what's happening with our kids.
Governor Evers, I'm sorry, I'm going to just jump in here because we only have a few seconds left. But, you know, Governor Evers proposing a $2.6 billion funding increase to K-12 schools in the next budget. What is your message as they craft a budget for school spending?
Absolutely, is that there is there is need, and we would love to have more, you know, support from the state, as there are so many different things that we're trying to accomplish in the district, as well as really just trying to make sure that there's access and equity in all, and that all kids in our community have access to a high quality education. So I would really encourage the prioritization of public schools, because that's how we're going to move our state forward.
Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Tiffany Tardy is Executive Director of the Milwaukee Public Schools Foundation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a visit to a winter competition.
Snow Snake is a traditional game played by tribes during the winter. It originated with the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Confederacy out east. Tribal members craft javelins out of wood called snow snakes, and they compete to see who can throw them the farthest. WPR's Daniel Kading made the trek to Madeline Island this winter as members of tribes from around the region attended the Mooning Wanakoning Minis Intertribal Snow Snake Festival.
For only the second time in more than 150 years, members of tribes from across the region are playing snow snake on Madeline Island. It's a crisp Saturday in February, and the sun shines overhead as dozens gather on a snow-covered Lake Superior beach. Men 55 and older are throwing snow snakes down what looks like a channel carved out of snow. Paul Ninham is among them. He's a member of the Oneida Nation, which is one of the tribes that make up the Iroquois Confederacy. He's been teaching Indigenous games for almost four decades.
The snake has got to stay in there. It can and it will jump the track at times, so that's no throw. And so what we're doing here is we're just kind of like making up our rules. Everybody's taking three throws.
Someone then uses a flag to mark how far each person's snake went. Ninham just got done throwing a snow snake made by his brother. Unfortunately, it veered off track.
It was going pretty good, I bet.
And then to the left.
Oh.
Snow snake and other Indigenous games hadn't been played on the island until recently. The federal government banned the practice long ago due to wagering on the games. Oneida Nation tribal member Paul Demain says the game's return is part of a broader effort to restore tribal culture, lands, and language.
We're just trying to bring it back a little bit more into context for the kids and giving them skills and encouragement and fun and camaraderie.
That baby was going, too.
Bill Quackenbush threw a longer snow snake made out of maple that he waxed. He clinched the longest throw for men 55 and older at 309 feet. A tribal historic preservation officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation, Quackenbush says the game helped tribal members hone their hunting skills.
You know, when times of old, especially when the deer would herd up, or if you'd have these groups of animals in there in waist deep of snow, a snow snake or a spear of that time would travel very easily across the snow, and you could harvest animals if you needed to in the winter.
Quackenbush says it's good to see the game brought back to a place that plays an important role to northern Wisconsin tribes. Madeline Island is considered the ancestral homeland of the Ojibwe people, including the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
Are you ready?
Red Cliff tribal member Sandy Goki, who goes by the name Wenepishtabe, had the longest throw among women 54 and under at about 293 feet. She says the game is a way to honor the suffering that her ancestors went through to hold on to their culture as the federal government forced them to assimilate and give up their lands.
We don't have to hide it. We're right out in the middle of the lake now doing this. 100 years ago to 50 years ago, that wasn't the case. We couldn't do that.
Frank Sprague never knew the game growing up. He's a member of the Gun Lake Band of Potawatomi Indians from southwest Michigan. Now he makes his own snow snakes using wood like hickory, maple, or popple that's been dried in a kiln so they won't warp over time. He says the game brings tribal communities together.
You know, the wintertime is very tough, very hard on us. And this is just a way for us to get out and compete, you know, in a good way.
Ninham with the Oneida Nation says the game was considered medicine as it lifted people's spirits during the winter. He adds that tribes also use snow snakes to send messages through markings on the wood when villages needed to meet or visitors were entering their territories. Ninham says it's important to restore the games so they'll continue to be played long into the future.
If we don't continue to practice and play these games that the Creator has given us, our original games, those games too are going to go away.
While the cold of winter may have settled over the island, Ninham says his heart is warm watching everyone play.
Ooh, that's nice.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story from the Snow Snake Festival. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new additions to educational resources from PBS Wisconsin. One is its Wisconsin Biographies collection that brings to life stories from Wisconsinites of the past and recognizes their contributions through these short animated videos, digital books, historical images, and other creative ways. Call in with questions about this biography collection, what you wonder about it, and the people who shaped Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alyssa Sagong is Chief Curiosity Officer at PBS Wisconsin, oversees its education work. Alyssa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Good morning. So how do you decide which biographies to work on and prioritize for inclusion in this collection?
Oh, that's a great question. It is an art and a science. But first of all, our most important bosses are all of Wisconsin's educators. So we take a lot of ideas and feedback from them, from our partners. We look to our friends at DPI and other places to see what our needs, what's not being met in currently available curricular materials. And so a big focus for Wisconsin Biographies in the last couple of years has been expanding representation in the collection so that kids all over Wisconsin can see their culture and things that are relevant to their past and their neighbors in this work.
So, how do you, as I watch these just beautiful animated short videos, how do you research and craft the stories and ensure that they're accurate to the person's life experiences in Wisconsin?
Well, a great example of how we do that is our most recent biography, Geshe Lundup Sopa, Carrying Teachings from Tibet. Tibetan culture is complex and rich and beautiful. And so to make that work be truly representative and accurate, we worked with a wide variety of advisors, from an educator cohort to the monks at Deer Park Buddhist Monastery, which is the place that Geshe Lundup Sopa founded, and also cultural advisors, musicians, the illustrator who did all of the beautiful artwork for this piece is a Tibetan woman who grew up in Madison and went to art school. And so she was able to capture those really specific details that anybody watching who has a connection to Tibetan culture recognizes the authenticity.
We're going to just hear an excerpt now of the video.
The Dalai Lama had a special request for him, to go to America with three other monks and learn English. This way, the Dalai Lama's message of peace and compassion could spread around the world. Lundup Sopa realized this was a chance for him to help preserve the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism in another part of the world.
Can you explain a little bit further how Lundup Sopa came to Wisconsin?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Geshe Sopa, like so many Tibetan people, escaped Tibet in 1959 when the Dalai Lama left due to the Chinese occupation. And so he was already a prominent scholar of Buddhist philosophy at that point. And so like we heard in that clip, His Holiness the Dalai Lama asked him if he would come to the United States
with some other monks to help learn English and to be connected. And he was offered a job at UW-Madison teaching introductory Tibetan. One of our advisors shared that this is sort of like the Pope coming to UW-Madison and being asked to teach introductory Latin. So he was an excellent teacher of Tibetan language and then culture and became part of that department. And over time, people wanted to tap into more of his wisdom. And he had students all over the world that would come to Deer Park to learn from him.
How did he decide on putting the, putting the Buddha Center in Oregon on the outskirts of Madison and Dane County?
My understanding was that he, along with students, had been looking for a place that they could set up and offer that knowledge to whoever was looking for it. And after a lot of searching, that space and that property was available, and the rest is history, as they say. There began with a really small temple when the Dalai Lama came to the U.S. to perform the Kala Chakra ceremony in 1981 at Geshe Sopa's invitation. And then over time, that center grew and grew. And today there's an extraordinary Tibetan Buddhist temple that is really accurate to what you would find in the Himalayas.
Well, let's turn to another biography. This one, the late Mahmud Atman Atta. What is his story?
Mahmud has also an incredible story, and there's actually some parallels to Geshe Sopa. We found his story as a part of a project that we're doing at PBS Wisconsin called the Wisconsin Muslim Project. And this is a project that's supported by the Doris Duke Foundation's Building Bridges program. And we have amazing partners in that, the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition and We Are Many, United Against Hate. So we worked with them to identify the story. And Mahmud grew up in Palestine. And when he was a little boy, his father would make trips to the U.S. to sell goods and worked as a peddler to support his family. And when Mahmud grew older, he came with his father to Milwaukee and he stayed to go to school here. He eventually served in the army and then he returned to Palestine to get married. But not long after that, war in the Middle East forced his family to leave Palestine. So seeking a sense of community in Milwaukee and here in Wisconsin, they decided to work with others to open the first mosque in Milwaukee that was open to all Muslims. He was really a bridge builder and a community builder.
And we're going to hear now just a little bit of that clip from that animated video.
There was no official place for all the city's Muslims to gather together and worship. Mahmud began reaching out to other Muslims in Milwaukee and forming connections. Many were Black Americans who were new to the religion. Segregation was a big problem in the city, so Mahmud built bridges by connecting with Black Muslims.
And I did, as you mentioned, hear the connections a little bit, some parallels to the story that we hear in Lundub Sopa's story about, you know, making those connections and finding a space.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing to look into all of the people of Wisconsin and our histories of how we came here, and of course, our First Nations neighbors that have always been here. And those are some of the really popular biographies in our collection as well. Mahmud's story will be live on our website by the end of next week. It's not even officially out. You're getting a sneak peek.
We're exploring PBS Wisconsin Education Resources with its Chief Curiosity Officer, Alyssa Sagong. Call in with questions and comments about PBS Wisconsin's educational materials, tools you use that make an impression on your students in the classroom, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are exploring new educational classroom media developed by our friends at PBS Wisconsin. One collection is called Resound, Songs of Wisconsin, and the goal is to enhance general music programs, music education for 4th through 8th graders. Call in with your questions about Resound or what you think of video interviews with Wisconsin musicians. 800-642-1234. Chief Curiosity Officer Alyssa Sagong stays with us. And we also have Lori Fellens here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin School Music Association and the Wisconsin Music Educators Association. Lori, welcome back.
Good morning. So great to be here with both of you.
Lori, what are educators seeking from this collection of music?
Oh, our educators are really excited that this has come to be. We ran a statewide survey in 2019 and listening sessions with Alyssa's great team. We learned about their need for current, authentic, and culturally diverse resources through those listening sessions. And with this collection coming to life, our educators' needs are being met in that they now have culture bearer voice in their classroom along with educator guides and curated resources. So we're just so proud of the work that's been done by PBS Wisconsin Education.
Well, we're going to dive into one of these vignettes, if you will, with the musician featured in Resound, a new addition here, Lavinia Surrender, the Brookfield-based musician and dancer. Let's hear an excerpt from her performance video in the collection. Alyssa, what do you appreciate about this music?
Oh, Kate, the music, as you can hear, and the dance from Southern India is so rich. It combines those complex and beautiful percussion sounds and string instruments with these really precise, but also really graceful dance from that. It creates a multi-sensory experience. It's so beautiful to listen to, but you absolutely have to visit the website to see how beautiful the performance is.
Mm. And Lori, I really love when I watched the video of how she explains storytelling through music and just that merging of dance and music. Can you explain that a little further?
Yeah, I think in our Americanized culture, we think of them as separate. But in cultures such as described here, art merges. And so when dance and music come together, they are one. And that's a concept that's just so beautifully brought out through this particular musician.
And this is a form of Indian classical music that also tells ancient stories from Indian mythology. How does that resonate now? And how do you incorporate that, Alyssa, into the classroom setting as you teaching, you know, some general music education?
Well, Lori is really our expert in teaching general music education, but it's, you know, my understanding that the way that these resources are used is to bring that variety of voices directly from the culture bearers so that students are exposed to musicians, just like in Wisconsin biographies, that both spark their curiosity about other cultures, but also and oftentimes are reflecting their own cultures.
Mm. Talking with Alyssa Sagong, Chief Curiosity Officer at PBS Wisconsin, Lori Fellens is here, leads two Wisconsin associations focused on music education. You can join in along the way on educational resources, 800-642-1234. Let's move on to Black River Review, a four-piece freshwater bluegrass and Americana band from Duluth and Superior. And this group is now featured in Resound. And let's listen to part of the song, Outer Space.
I wanna fly out of space. I wanna leave this world a better place. Circle the moon, make my way towards Mars. I wanna live my life beyond the stars. Whoa.
Lori, this video, it just really captivated me. And I think that one image of him strumming his guitar and looking out at the great big lake was just so breathtaking. Can you tell us a little bit more about this bluegrass band?
Yeah, I love that we chose Black River Review for several reasons. One, they come from up in the Superior Duluth area where that bridge, you know, bridges two states, bridges two communities, but they share a very, you know, conjoined culture up there. And so this is an amazing group who, when you watch the venue that they're into, super authentic to that northern Wisconsin space and place. And I love that this piece was inspired by their third grade teacher, who loved space. And so their intergalactic shout out to their teacher is just an amazing part of this story.
And they're performing, it seems like, Alyssa, in this like warehouse setting, and it's just everything is driving to this intense connection to home and community. And then you have the layer of the bluegrass music really helping drive that as well. What do you hear in this music?
Well, Lori definitely stole my favorite part too. I love that it's a shout out to your teachers. But I will say, you know, what you're noticing in the production of these videos is the incredible work by our team, working together with WSMA to identify musicians and spaces and the beautiful production quality. So I would say another favorite part are the starry elements that are added to the warehouse in our post-production. So.
Oh, that is fabulous. And just, I wonder too, you know, bringing students closer, Lori, to elements of Lake Superior in the music and really understanding how understanding music is also a connection to the artistic roots of someone, where they come from. How do you hear that in this piece?
Well, I think the quote that's contained within this about how music allows you to travel the world without ever leaving home. And when you sit and read someone's music, you get a bit inside their mind. That's part of the quote that's attached with this. I think that's the beauty of not only Black River Review's segment, but how it intersects with all of the artists in the collection, because this idea of we are traveling the world, we're traveling to spaces even within our own state we don't always get to, and some of our students have never seen before. So there's such a power, especially in this Black River Review collection, about that identity with home.
I think I want to land on their line. I want to leave this world a better place. That was, I just love that line in the song. Well, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was great to be with you today, Kate and Lori. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. It's anytime I can spend any time with Alyssa in a space. We're just so proud to work with PBS Wisconsin Education on this project. It's just great to be here with you.
Alyssa Sagong, Chief Curiosity Officer at PBS Wisconsin, and Lori Fellens, Executive Director of the Wisconsin School Music Association and the Wisconsin Music Educators Association. Find links to the Wisconsin biographies and ReSound on our program page, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.